Rebonjour à toutes et à tous. Eh bien, c'est un grand plaisir d'accueillir avec nous aujourd'hui Jean-Philippe Brantu. Jean-Philippe Brantu est professeur sur la chaire Sandoz, je crois, à l'EPFL depuis déjà 6 ans, 2016. Alors Jean-Philippe, c'est quelqu'un qui est bien connu ici puisqu'il a fait sa thèse à Palaiseau dans le groupe d'optique quantique. Il me disait qu'en fait, il avait fait le déménagement de Orsay à Palaiseau. Donc c'était vraiment il a fait partie de ceux qui ont essuyé les plâtres au sens propre et au sens figuré du bâtiment de Palaiseau. Il a fait sa thèse donc, oui, dans le groupe d'Alain Aspect avec Philippe Bouillet. La thèse de Jean-Philippe était vraiment très jolie. C'était plein de choses qu'on pouvait faire avec les pièges dipolaires. Et moi, je me souviens en particulier de ce trampoline atomique qui était très joli. On voyait les atomes qui rebondissaient sur un miroir fait avec une onde stationnaire. C'était très, très, très belle manip. Tu avais aussi, je crois, fait les premiers pas dans le propagation en présence de désordre à deux dimensions, qui était aussi quelque chose de très joli. Ensuite, Jean-Philippe est allé chez Tillman Leslinger, d'abord comme postdoc, Marie Curie, et puis après comme, je ne sais pas quel était le titre officiel, Research Assistant peut-être, quelque chose comme ça.
Oberassistant.
Oberassistant. Voilà. Et là, il y a eu aussi une cascade de résultats vraiment très spectaculaires qui a concerné tout ce qui était conduction de fermions dans des canaux, quantification de la conductance. Il y a eu des expériences faites avec des points quantiques qui étaient mis et ils étudiaient comment se comportait donc le flux à travers ce point quantique. Donc c'est des très belles manips. Et donc depuis 2016, il a pris ce poste à l'EPFL et un de ses thèmes de recherche, ce dont il va nous parler aujourd'hui, c'est là encore des très jolies expériences. C'est un gaz Fermi en interaction forte couplé à une cavité fortement. Donc ça fait deux fois fort. Voilà. Et donc, merci beaucoup, Jean-Philippe, d'être venu jusqu'à nous pour nous présenter ça.
OK. So I'm going to speak English, following the recommendations of Jean, but of course, feel free to ask questions in French. I will also answer in French in this case. So thanks a lot for the introduction. It's a bit intimidating, I should say, to talk after the lecture and after such a kind introduction. It's actually doubly intimidating in a sense because I'm also going to talk about cavity quantum electrodynamics experiments. And this place is of course special in this respect, and probably several of you know this topic much better than I do. So that is a bit of also kind of an imposter syndrome that I kind of feel here. But anyway, so as Jean explained, I'm going to tell you about experiments which we've been doing at EPFL over the last few years, which deal with ultra-cold Fermi gases that we trap in a high-finesse cavity. And I'm going to tell you the few surprises you get out of the interplay of the interaction between atoms and interactions of these atoms with light. So before coming to the topic, I'd like to introduce the people who actually do the job in the lab. And I'm mostly going to talk about this particular experiment about Fermi gases. But yes, most and actually all the results have actually been taken by these people. And Kevin and Hideki have actually left the group. But I want to also credit them for the results I'm going to present. So I will suppose that you are a bit more familiar with ultra-cold atoms than perhaps with cavity QEDs, and I'm going to introduce very, very briefly what we mean by this and why this can be considered interesting, and I should apologize for the people who can tell these things while they sleep, essentially. So if you consider an atom, say, ground and excited state, a two-level atom, and you place it inside the cavity, you drive the cavity and put photons in. Once the photon is in, and if the frequency of the photon matches that of the transition, the photon can be absorbed by the atom and back, and this process and re-emitted back in the cavity mode. This process can be coherent, and the rate at which this happens is the Rabi frequency of the light matter coupling strength. This is very simple, and that stays coherent as long as other dissipation processes are small or negligible. And there are different kinds of dissipation processes. The first one is that the atom might emit the photon not in the mode of the cavity, but somewhere else. And the second process is that once the photon is in the cavity, it can actually come out. So these are the two main processes which compete with the coherent exchange of energy between atom and light. And the figure of merit, the dimensionless figure of merit, which quantifies whether this process is coherent or not, is called the cooperativity. This is a dimensionless parameter which will tell you whether the light is strongly or weakly coupled to the atom. So this is something, this is the main player of the talk that I'm, for everything that I'm going to tell you about later. Just one comment here, the likelihood that an excited atom emits light in the cavity mode as opposed to the free space, that's quantified by this, has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. It's a purely classical process. Nevertheless, this number is what enters with pretty much all the quantum information protocols by which you try, for example, to entangle matter with light or this kind of things. Right? So it's extremely important. And actually, of course, I should refer to if you're interested, please have a look at this book. Of course, you will have everything that you need to know about the process. And I should also, I want to mention this paper here by the Vuletic group, which very nicely explains the classical origin as purely from the interference of the light that's emitted by the atom and the light that's reflected by the mirrors. This is extremely nice and pedagogical if you want to know more. So, when the cooperativity is high enough, you can do very simple transmission spectroscopy experiments, and you see that this is a very simple simulation that one can do. And with large cooperativities, what you observe is that as opposed to having a single transmission peak when light is resonant with the cavity, the spectrum features two modes, which are splitted here by the Hubble frequency. And this normal mode splitting is something which can be used to characterize whether the light-matter coupling is strong or weak. And here, these two modes that appear here are usually called polaritons, and they represent the Drest state, which mix light excitations and matter excitations. I should say, by the way, that, of course, this is classical as long as one photon in the cavity is not able to saturate this transition, of course. Huh? I mean, which is going to be the case for everything I'm going to tell you about. But, of course, I mean, there's much more to cavity QED than what I'm telling here. Again, the experts are probably in this room anyway, so I'm not going to say more. So This process here is extremely general, so as long as you put light emitters in the cavity, you can try to observe, and most likely succeed, to observe these kind of features. I would like to organize this landscape along these two different axes. So one axis here is the strength of light-matter coupling, and if you use single emitters, you can go to extremely large coupling strengths. Of course, I refer again to this very famous experiment that have been done here over the last 20 years. And but you have many systems that can actually reach very strong light-matter coupling, of course, in the superconducting circuits, in the microwave domain, but also in the optical domain, not only with atoms, but now with semiconductor nanostructures. And this is by no means an exhaustive picture, so this is just a few chosen examples. Now, what my field of research is quantum simulation, and for that we would like to investigate many-body systems. So many-body system means we would like to start to have first many particles and then hopefully go to larger and larger interactions. So going to many particles is something for which a key step has been achieved in about 15 years ago with the coupling not of one atom but n exactly identical atom to the field of the cavity. And that was the production of Bose-Einstein condensate, which has achieved, in particular at ENS, but also at ETH Zurich. This is now there are now many groups working with these Bose condensates inside high-finesse cavities. So this is sort of going in this direction. If one goes now this way, there are now examples of systems that are extremely strongly correlated. I want to point out in particular this example. It's a high-TC superconductor that's studied by the group of Thomas Ebesen in Strasbourg, in which this material was placed in the vicinity of a plasmonic resonance, so close to a gold mirror, and it was observed that the critical temperature changes out of the coupling of this material with light. I'm not sure this is completely understood. For sure, this is ongoing research, in this field, and this is something which is extremely interesting. I should also mention a large amount of activity that is taking place using two-dimensional materials of different kinds. And I've seen that you will have Attachi Mamoglu in a few weeks here presenting. He is one of the best experts of this topic, so I'm also not going to enter the details. But this landscape is very rich, and there's all kinds of systems which one can couple with light and hopefully observe new physical phenomena. With ultra-cold atoms, we're able also to produce strongly interacting systems. In particular, about 5 years ago, a MOT insulator of atoms has been produced also in high-finesse cavities, showing the strong coupling regime. In this area, I should also mention the large amount of theory activities. I only talked about experiments, but there are many, many proposals that suggest ways by which the light-matter interaction can be used to further control this system. So the system I'd be interested in the rest of this talk is the unitary Fermi gas. So you can think of this as essentially going as far away as possible along this axis and reaching interaction strengths for atom-atom interaction that is as large as permitted by quantum mechanics. And this is the system which we'd like to place in the cavity. And as I will show you, there are a few surprises which show up. Because these systems, due to the fact that they are strongly interacting, they actually interact with light also in a slightly different way. So this is the outline of my talk. So I'm first going to tell you how this is exactly done. And I will not enter into a lot of experimental details, but I will show you basically how we characterize these systems. And then I'm going to show you two examples by which this atom-atom interaction plays together with the light-matter coupling. Which is the observation of pair polaritons and some studies of the optomechanical response, which are two ways by which the interactions of atoms show up in the light spectroscopy. And then the last topic is ongoing research in the lab for now a few months, and we think we can now not only use the cavity to measure how the atoms interact with each other, but to really change the state of matter and have a new phases that show up out of the coupling with light. And this is, I will show you some preliminary results which we have obtained, but that's something we are excited about, and you might have some questions or comments that would be useful at that stage. So let's start. So the first thing one should clarify is what happens if you have, instead of one atom, many atoms. I showed you this super simplistic picture before. The first thing which happens if you have many emitters in the cavity is that the cooperativity is scaled by the number of emitters. And that is simply, at least if the emitters are identical. And that comes from the fact that these emitters, they are in the cavity, they are driven by the same cavity mode. So they are like oscillating dipoles. So the field that's radiated is coherent because all the emitters are driven in a coherent way. And because of this, it interferes constructively, and you get a much larger emission in the cavity mode than you would have if the emitter was alone. And that increases the cooperativity by a factor of n. The price you pay for that is that all the nonlinearities you might have with a single atom are washed away, but this is not something we'll be concerned about in this presentation. This is completely general. You have it regardless of the quantum state of the system you're putting in. There might be thermal, bosons, fermions, whatever. This is just a purely classical electrodynamics effect. Actually, in the lab, how do we place these atoms? And I wanted to show this picture. So this is the lab about 5.5 years ago. Now it looks slightly more like this. And I want to show this because I want to credit again the PhD students and postdocs who have done the job. Anybody who has set up or tried to set up a cold atom experiment knows how hard it is. And so I'm going to sweep nicely over like 3.5 years of work to turn this into that. I want to really say that I had an amazing team to do this work. And I still have an amazing team now, and they are the people who actually deal with this beast. So if you were to look here inside, you would see a vacuum chamber. And inside this vacuum chamber, so that's now an artist's view of it, you would have here at the center the cavity. So these are the two mirrors of the cavity that are placed inside the vacuum system. These are the numbers for the optical cavity. That's for the expert. The finesse is something like 47,000. So there are 4 centimeters here between the two, which allows us to do all the preparation of the cloud in between the two mirrors. So with laser cooling, evaporative cooling, and so on. This all takes place here, which gives us a very nice and efficient way of producing the clouds. It's also pretty fast. We have duty cycles of a few seconds only. If you want to know more, there's this technical paper which contains all the details about the experiment. So this is the cavity as it is. And in between here, we prepare clouds of lithium-6 atoms with strong interactions that we produce using the Fischbach resonance. The numbers is that we have roughly 500,000 lithium-6 atoms, sometimes a bit less, sometimes a bit more, depending on the status of the experiment. And we cool them down to temperatures of the order of 0.1 times the Fermi temperature. There again, it depends exactly on the details of how we perform the evaporation and which interaction strength we are using. And you see here the condensation of fermion pairs, which is a manifestation of the fact that at sufficiently low temperature, these interacting fermions simply become superfluid by Cooper pairing. So this is the system which we are coupling with light. And now I'm going to do the experiments basically that I described above schematically. That is, we just send light onto the system and see the transmission spectrum. In order to understand the transmission spectrum, one needs to know a bit more details about how the system actually looks like. I show you here the energy levels of lithium in a strong magnetic field. So we have here the relevant energy levels. So at high magnetic field here, we work at high magnetic field because we use Fischbach resonances. That Fischbach resonance happens to be at 832 Gauss for lithium-6. And at that particular field, the relevant levels are these two here, which are the two lowest hyperfine states, and one excited state here, to which we are going to send the atoms when they absorb photons. These two here are separated by about 80 megahertz, and we are going to be dealing with atoms that are forming as an equal mixture between up and down here. So for fermions, we have 50% spin up, 50% spin down. I'm going to call this up and down, but these are really hyperfine states of lithium-6. So we have now these two ground states instead of one, and then again, we send light, and of course, we have about, as I told you, 500,000 of these atoms in the cavity. So when we do this transmission spectroscopy experiment, we have two control parameters. One here is this delta A, and the way we choose this is by choosing the cavity length. Once we choose the cavity length, that tells us which frequency is sustained by the cavity mode. And now we have chosen this frequency, and delta A is the difference between that frequency and the one of the transition between the atoms. Okay, so that's chosen by fixing the cavity length. And once the cavity length is fixed, we send photons, we drive the cavity with a laser, which frequency we change, and there's a detuning delta C here, which is the detuning between the empty cavity resonance and the laser, right? We're going to sweep this frequency here and change this one as well, and that gives us this 2D map that you see here. This is delta C, this is delta A. So that looks rather complicated, but if you look at it first, if there wouldn't be any atom, what you would see is a transmission here, which is always located at zero detuning, meaning delta C is zero here. We just send light to the cavity, it's resonant, and nothing happens. Now, if we were just to have only the atoms, but no cavity, what we would see is two absorption features, which would correspond to the two ground states of my atom, and they would correspond to these lines here. That's where we would see absorption. And now when we put the two systems together, what we see is dressed states. You see branches here, which correspond to the coupled light matter excitations. We see one branch here. We should see here in between another branch, and the third one down here. If we have just two ground state and one photonic mode, they mix the three, and we should get these three branches. So it looks much more complicated than that. And the main reason is that the cavity is actually not just single mode. So this is something we understand pretty well. That's completely ab initio calculation, just with what we know about the cavity that we can measure independently, putting the number of atoms we think we have inside the cavity and calculating the transmission spectrum. It's a classical calculation that you know, even I can do. There's no adjustable parameters of any kind, and that's what we expect. The slight differences that we see here can be explained by slight misalignments between the position of the cloud and the center of the cavity and so on. So that simply shows that indeed we achieve this strong coupling regime. The cooperativity is pretty large. The Dress state branches are a manifestation of that. Of course, at that stage, that spectrum doesn't really care whether the atoms are interacting with each other, whether they are degenerate bosons, fermions, or whatever. It just shows that we understand the light-matter coupling pretty well in this situation. And if you look a bit carefully here, you will see extra features which clearly do not appear in the simulation, even at the qualitative level, and you see these lines here, for example. And these are things which I'm going to tell you about in a minute, because this is actually a manifestation of the strong light-matter coupling, strong atom-atom coupling, sorry. So, let's look in this spectrum more carefully and try to see whether it makes any difference if the atoms are interacting or not. And to understand that, you have to imagine what happens when you have not one atom interacting with light, but two. And when you have two atoms exposed to light, of course, what can happen is that one of the atoms scatters the photon or the other scatters the photon. So that's back to the previous configuration. But what these two atoms can also do is that they can absorb the photon together and be turned into a molecule. This process is called photoassociation. It's actually something that's well established in the field of ultra-cold atoms. I mentioned here a review article on this topic. And the idea is that if the two atoms are close enough to each other, they can be turned into an excited state molecule. That excited state molecule has a binding energy, right? And therefore, the optical resonance that you observe is actually shifted with respect to the single atom resonance by an amount here. And that amount is simply the binding energy. So what you expect to see is that the spectrum of the two atom plus one photon problem should also have these extra resonances on the red side of the single atom one. And now, of course, if you put now the cavity around and you have these photons interact with this particular resonance, the same game that I told you before is going to take place. That is, you can have coherent absorption and turning pairs of fermions into molecules and back. And if that coupling is strong enough, you're going to have coherent superpositions of photons and pairs. Now, let's look at the transmission spectrum of the cavity again. This is a close-up on these transmissions. You have this big here feature, which is just the coupling with one single atom state that is here at zero. And if you follow that, you see these resonances all over the place. And these ones are actually these photoassociation resonances. And when you look carefully at these pictures, you see that for each of them, you have a nice anti-crossing pattern. So for each of these, we actually observe the strong coupling regime. This was, to my knowledge, this is the first time that one gets coherent light-matter interaction for these particular transitions. This is something we called pair polaritons, because this is now coming from the coupling of pairs with photons. And the really cool thing is that, actually, if you look at this resonance, it is something which depends on how likely it is to actually have two atoms close to each other in order to form a molecule. Now, whether or not you have two atoms close to each other, that depends on the structure of the ground state. If you change the way atoms are interacting with each other, it will be more or less likely. That's a two-body correlation function of your gas. And if you write down a simple model for light-matter interaction, I just wrote the Hamiltonian here. This is a simplistic version of the light-matter interaction close to one of these photoassociation transitions. I think the details do not really matter, but you can show that what you expect to see is a Rabi frequency, the square of the Rabi frequency, so the splitting between these lines here, should be proportional, indeed, to the pair correlation function. So this pair correlation function is integrated over all your cloud. There's a cavity mode function here, which is simply the standing wave we have inside the cavity. There are functions here which are the molecular orbitals to which you're promoting your atoms. And you have here the pair correlation function in the ground state of the system. So this photoassociation process has been actually studied in the past quite extensively, actually, for the strongly correlated Fermi gas. The very same concepts can be applied here in this experiment. And what this means is that this splitting here should change when we change the way atoms are interacting with each other. And that's something we can do using the Fischbach resonance. So I make the long story short. So we change here the scattering length using the Fishback resonance. And what we do is we measure the omega square, so this the square of the hub is splitting. What we do is we normalize by the value we have observed at unitarity. The reason for that is that there is a parameter here which depends on which molecular transition you're talking to. So this part, of course, is some molecular physics which we don't completely control, but what we know is that it more or less is constant when we change magnetic field. And therefore, by normalizing, we are left only with the variations of the pair correlation function itself. And indeed, for four different photoassociation transitions, when we measure this number, we find the same universal curve. And this universal curve is the pair correlation function of the ground state of the strongly interacting Fermi gas. And this is something which has actually been calculated, and it turns out that it's described by Tan's relations. It depends on one parameter, which is called the contact, so you probably know much more about this in the next lectures by Jean. And there again, we took one of the calculations, a Monte Carlo calculation of the contact that was published in this paper, and there's no free parameter. This is how our data look like. So what we have achieved with this is that we look at the optical spectrum. We see Rabi splittings, which can be of tens of megahertz. So this is like 2-3 orders of magnitudes larger than the Fermi energy of the gas. Nevertheless, this Rabi frequency is directly the fingerprint of the pair correlations that we have in the ground state. There's another way to interpret this data, in particular the fact that it's the square which actually matters, is to remember what it means to have n particles instead of one. I told you that when we increase the number of emitters in the cavity, we are actually increasing the cooperativity by an amount that's proportional to the number of atoms. So here, what you just have to do is to count the number of pairs. And when you do that, so the contact is actually a measurement of the number of pairs. And if you measure the Rabi frequency as a function of the number of pairs that you change by changing interactions, you see the square root scaling, which is, again, nothing but saying that the cooperativity scales was the number of emitters, but the number of emitters are now the pairs. And with this plot, you can give a rough estimate. So this is very rough because we don't completely control the molecular physics. But what we see here is that the Rabi frequency for a single pair coupled to photon is of the order of the Rabi frequency for a single atom. And what this means is that pretty much everything we do with coupling atoms and photons, we can directly map it onto coupling pairs to photons with the same experimental setup. So you can do cavity QED with pairs now in the same way as we were doing it with individual atoms in the past. So this is the first way by which the interactions can play with the light matter coupling. There's another way which we have discovered last year, is that you can also operate the system not in the resonant regime by which the photons are actually going to be scattered by the atoms, but in the dispersive regime. So what you do is you change the length of the cavity to the extent that the photons that are sustained by the cavity can no longer be scattered. And what you're left with is a refractive effect. So the atoms are just going to change slightly the index of refraction of the medium. And therefore, the cavity length is effectively changed. This is the Hamiltonian that describes that. And what you're going to get is second order processes by which the atom is only virtually being excited. And this coupling has, as I said, an effect of changing the effective length of the cavity. So what's going to happen is that the frequency of resonance is actually going to be slightly shifted. And it is shifted here by an amount which you can read from this Hamiltonian. It's simply the dispersive shift per atom times the overlap of the density of the cloud with the cavity mode. The mode of the cavity is a standing wave, and therefore you have the cosine here. And using this, you can, for example, measure this dispersive shift and count how many atoms you have in your cavity. And that's something we have done in the past. And the cool thing is that this is essentially non-destructive, because there's no real scattering of photons. Of course, one should have a look at the details. It's not really QND. But in fact, when we actually take one cloud of fermions and we measure this by sweeping over the cavity resonance, checking where light gets transmitted, turns out we can repeat this typically 500 times over a single realization. So this is one atomic cloud, which we have prepared here. And for 5 seconds, we measure 100 times per second where the dispersive shift actually is, and we can reconstruct this curve. This is one realization, and measuring now, and it's much more tedious, the temperature as we perform this experiment. So we stop after some time, measure the temperature. We do this many times. We can see that the heating is actually very low. Actually, we can do this for almost 2 seconds before the gas reaches the critical temperature, by which it's not superfluid anymore. So that's kind of cool. And it tells you also the kind of feature you get in the lab with the cavity, that you get you get a lot of signal for a given realization of the experiment, which is really nice. Now, by the way, if you do it with pairs, you also have a dispersive shift that's due to coupling to photo association, and you can do the same thing. You can track the pair correlation function in time over a single cloud and show also that this is very weakly destructive. That's something we have done as well, together with the pair polariton studies. Now, what I want to tell you now is that you can study this and have a look at it and say, wait a minute, I mean, this is also an optical lattice which I imprint on my atoms, which strength is given by the number of photons inside the cavity. That's another way to interpret this Hamiltonian, and in such a way that if I put a lot of photons in my cavity, I'm going to change the shape of the cloud, and sure enough, some of the atoms will be shifted towards, say, the antinode of the standing wave. And as they move from node to antinode, of course, the index of refraction is also changing. If all the atoms are located at the antinode, the shift is actually twice larger than if they are uniformly distributed. So as you send light in your cavity, you start to form this density modulation, and the location of the resonance moves. And this is just a cavity optomechanics experiment, by which you have a collective motion of the atom. That's this density fluctuation mode, which is coupled with the effective length of your cavity. So this is something that was studied quite extensively with Bose-Einstein condensates, in particular in the group of Dan Stamper-Kern over the last 15 years. And what we are doing here now is we're just taking this strongly correlated Fermi gas and try to understand how this happens. What you should think is that we are going to start the measurement by setting the frequency of our probe laser somewhere here, and we just sweep across the resonance. And as we do that, there's light will start to enter the cavity, and as light enters, the cloud gets modulated, and because it's modulated, the length of the cavity is also changing. If you do it with increasing laser probe power, what you see is that for low power, you have a relatively nicely Lorentzian transmission for your cavity. But if you do it with stronger and stronger power, you see this very strong distortion. And the distortion is due to the fact that the cavity length is changing as a function of the power that you have inside. This is something which we can measure in details. It's actually very difficult to get a quantitative agreement with a model for this kind of curves. There's only a small, limited window of parameters in which this actually works, and you can fit the entire curve that you see here, including the wings, with a model which you can understand. And when you do that, you can basically measure this particular parameter, which tells you how deep the density modulation is as a result of a given strength of the optical lattice. And that's the density response function. And this density response function is a many-body property. It depends how strongly the atoms are interacting with each other. So we do these experiments, and we measure this as a function of interaction strength. And we refer again, we set to one here the parameter that quantifies the nonlinearity for the unitary Fermi gas. And that's the sort of the trend as we change the interaction strength. And now you can start to compare with the possible calculations of this density response function. So that was done for us by Shun Uchino from the Japanese Atomic Energy Agency. And he did this by operator product expansion. That's mainly because the wave vector of light is larger than the Fermi wave vector. So one can do a sort of systematic expansion in this ratio. And that's the theory we get. I should say that at least on the BEC side, it could at that stage, we don't completely control the theory here, but the overall trend is, I think, nicely reproduced. And what this theory tells us is that the reason why the nonlinearity is increasing when interaction is going over unitarity is because of the change of the contact. So it's, again, the same parameter that controls the pair correlations that is also entering this result. And this is something which one can directly see in the experiment. Okay, so these are two different ways by which one can get the signature on the optics of the strong interactions. But let's try to go one step further in the last, say, 10 minutes of this presentation. So far, again, the atoms do what they want to do as a result of the strong correlations. We send light and we learn how they behave. But what we can do is change the way they behave using light, and we do that by inducing interactions using the cavity. How does this work? We have again my two atoms. We work in the dispersive regime, but we now illuminate the atoms from the side and not on the axis of the cavity. And when we do that, say this atom will be driven, and it can do some Rayleigh scattering. And if it does this Rayleigh scattering of light, it's very likely to be done in the cavity. Why? Because if the cooperativity is high enough, as soon as this atom is driven, it wants to scatter in the cavity. And once it does that, all the atoms that are in the cavity, they see this field that has been scattered by the first one. And they react accordingly. They get driven by this light. And if you think of this process now as a second order process, what you can get is that one photon is emitted here inside the cavity and rescattered by a second atom. That happens typically when the pump laser is detuned with respect to the cavity resonance, such that you only virtually populate the cavity and not effectively with photons. It's very similar to the dispersive scattering here. You never populate the excited state, but you get effectively a second-order process. And this second-order process you can write as an effective atom-atom interaction that's now mediated by light. So again, I mean, this process here is proportional to the strength of the dispersive coupling of atoms to the cavity. Alpha square here is the strength of this pump drive. So if I increase the power, I increase the strength of this interaction. And here I have a detuning, which is the detuning of the pump with respect to the cavity. And again, it's a second order process. It's like 1/1 the detuning in the dipole force, for example. This also means that we can change the sign of this interaction by choosing whether we are red detuned or blue detuned with respect to the cavity. The important thing is that this interaction has some spatial structure, and the space dependence here is inherited from the shape of the pump beam and the shape of the cavity mode. GP here is the mode function of the pump. Usually it's a standing wave, so we have a standing wave, so basically two pumps one way and the other way around. GC here is the standing wave that is sustained by the cavity, so that's essentially the result of the boundary conditions, if you want, set by the cavity mirrors. And that gives us an interaction that's typically uniform over space. It's not actually uniform, but it's long range because it's as large as the cavity mode. That actually was discovered, I think, first in the group of Gerhard Rempe in the early 2000s. And this is now something which is heavily used in our community. There are many experiments one can do using these cavity-induced interaction. Historically, I think it started with spin squeezing, which is the very same mechanism by which you can induce correlations between spin inside the cavity using a feedback mechanism mediated by the cavity field. And I just put it here references that are from last year because there are many, many from the years before. And it's really a growing community that's exploiting this for a lot of applications that you can see here. In particular, one has already seen self-organized Fermi gases without interactions that was published this summer. If you want to know more, there's a very nice and exhaustive review article by Helmut Rietsch and his collaborators that gives the whole picture on how to interpret these and what are the things that have been proposed and studied in the past. Okay, so now let's look again at our interacting gas. We now have, I plot here the total interaction potential as a function of momentum, which you know now very well. And if we have S-wave contact interaction, that's the Fischbach resonance, that's the Fermi gas we've produced, atoms colliding with a contact potential that's somehow uniform over momentum, at least up to certain values of K, and afterwards it holds down, as you now know. And this is something we control using the Fischbach resonance, right? So we tune magnetic field around 832 Gauss. And what we know is that, and that we know this because 20 years of studies, in particular here at ENS, have told us that the system is essentially becoming superfluid for low enough temperature as we take these fermions and cool them down in the vicinity of this resonance. And we can tune this interaction by changing the magnetic field. What we have on top of this is an interaction that's somehow the extreme opposite. That's the cavity-mediated interaction, which is comprising only of standing waves along different directions. So from the point of view of momentum structure, it's actually purely local. You have one particular wave vector here, and that's how the experiment looks like. We have the atoms here. We pump from the side with a certain wave vector P, and there's a cavity vector KC here. So there is one wave vector here, KC minus KP, at which this interaction is going to play. We can change the strength, and we can change the sign of this interaction. Interestingly for us, this K minus, so the one with the minus sign here, there is KC plus KP, which is kind of very far away on that side for our geometry. If you have questions, I can comment a bit more on this. But this here is smaller than the Fermi wave vector. So if you look at it in momentum space, you send light this way that gets scattered here. So the atoms are going to get a recoil kick in this direction. Of course, we have retroreflected pump beams. The cavity is a standing wave, so the reverse process is also happening. So you're just getting K minus here minus K minus here. And if this is the Fermi surface, now you have an interaction which couples these states with these ones. And again, this is local in momentum, so this is just a sort of discrete set of points that get coupled to each other. And now, what is the quantum state that you get? If you have an interaction that is local in momentum, so if it's local in space, you get superfluidity, that's what we know. If it's local in momentum, you should get charge density wave. At least that's what the typical condensed matter physics is telling you. And indeed, so this is now an experimental result. So we start to pump on that side. We have a lattice here, so this is supposed to be a lattice. It's actually a very, very short spacing, right? That's formed by just retroreflecting this beam. We increase the strength of this pump beam here as a function of time, right? And we count the number of photons we have inside the cavity. And for some time, essentially, nothing happens. But as you reach a critical pump power, the system sort of forms spontaneously a density wave. And that density wave has exactly the right Bragg structure so as to scatter the photon from the pump in the cavity. So when it forms, you directly get a signature of this by a jump of the photon that you observe inside the cavity as a function of time. So this is the ramp of the power, essentially interaction strength, and for critical interaction strength, this density wave is forming. This is something that has been observed and heavily studied again over the last 10-15 years, in particular in the Esslinger group at ETH. We now have this for strongly interacting fermions as well. With the geometry we have an interesting interplay with the Fermi wave vector because the momentum, the wavelength of this is actually larger than the Fermi wavelength. So, and I just want to also advertise the cavity. What's cool with the cavity is that you get a signal over a single realization. So this is one realization of the experiment where you directly see the transition from essentially uniform to density wave. We can actually do this study in a systematic way as a function of the different parameters. I'm probably not going to comment much more on this. So these are phase diagrams by which we change the strength of the pump power here and the tuning with respect to the cavity. So in principle, this transition line should be a line, right? Which is simply the dependence of this long-range interaction onto the tunings. That's something we can reconstruct. And we can do that for different strengths of the contact interaction from BEC to BCS, so changing the magnetic field and reproducing these experiments. And we can keep track, say, of where this line actually is as a function of magnetic field. So this is here the Fishback resonance. And we see how the density wave order plays against the contact interaction. For all values of interaction strength or contact interaction, we see the density wave transition. There is a smooth decrease from the BEC side to the BCS side, which is not extremely surprising. After all, the BEC is a bit softer. It's more compressible, so it actually easily forms this pattern, a bit easier actually than the BCS side. This is still work in progress. We would like to understand this a bit more quantitatively. We have a collaboration with the group of Helmut Rich. We are trying to reproduce this with calculations with a certain degree of accuracy that's going on. And the last thing I want to show is that we can also observe direct signature of this interaction even before the self-organization actually takes place. After all, there is a density, a susceptibility that is associated with the formation of this pattern. Again, similar to this optomechanics experiment I showed you before. And when this forms spontaneously, this just means that the system, without any external perturbation, just wants to do that kind of for free. So what we can do is we can measure this tendency of the system to form that particular density wave by sending the pump from the side and then basically seeding this using a small drive onto the cavity axis. So we poke the system a little bit, and we see whether or not it actually tends to form this in an easy or hard way. And again, the signature we have is that if the system actually wants to form this density wave, if we probe it very weakly, it's going to actually form it, and therefore a lot of light from the pump will be scattered in the cavity. So what we're going to see is that a very weak probe gets amplified by a lot, and this is something we have actually measured. So what we measure is the number of photons we get here for a given strength here of this drive, and that's again proportional to the susceptibility. And this susceptibility, as a function of the power, is seen to change. So if you have positive detunings, we see that it shoots up by an order of magnitude as we increase the power. It just means the system gets more and more soft, up to the point, of course, where without any external disturbance, it just spontaneously crystallizes. And the cool thing is that I told you we can choose the sign of this long-range interaction by changing the detuning. So if we do it with the opposite detuning, that's the blue points here, of course, there, the system doesn't want to crystallize. It actually gets harder and harder, right? It gets stiffer and stiffer, if you want. But this is something we see. We see a decrease of this susceptibility as we increase the pump power, simply because the system really does not want to do that. And what this means is that you send light here with your probe, and the system actually does not want to form this pattern in such a way that this light is actually scattered from the probe into the pump. So you have less light coming out than you send in. And I show you this because I think it also nicely illustrates the power of this cavity QED approach by which you can map the observables of your atomic system onto light. And that means that you can very easily probe things like the density wave susceptibility, which otherwise would require very good in situ imaging. So this is work in progress. There are many things which we don't understand about this particular system that wants to self-organize. We have to do a direct comparison with theory, at least at the mean field level. This is something we should be able to do and see what we get. We can measure frequency-dependent responses, similar to Bragg spectroscopy. So we send pump and probe with a different frequency, and then we start to see how the system gets excited or not. Everything is taking place in the cavity with some finite dissipation effect, so cooperativity is finite. And perhaps this has some consequences. This is something we also need to clarify. And there are, of course, many directions over which we could go. And I just want to mention one, which is the fact that the competition between pairing and density wave order is something you find in a lot of strongly correlated materials, in particular high-TC superconductors. This is a review article which tries to draw all the possible consequences you can have when you have these competing orders between spatial ordering and superfluidity. I don't know yet how related our system is to this kind of problems. There is a huge amount of literature here, but the hope is that a few things we can investigate are actually non-trivial from this point of view as well. And last thing I want to say is that so here I showed you we have these two extreme interactions, one which is purely local, one which is purely long range. It would be really interesting to be able to interpolate in between. And we have ideas on how to do that, to basically be able to program the way the system interacts with each other. I'm not going to say much more, but this is the topic of this new experiment that is being built also in my group, where we think we can control to some extent, essentially get out of this situation in which the long-range interaction is imposed by the mode function, but have something in which we can control locally which atom interacts with which. This is also work in progress in the group. So that's the summary of what I've been telling you about. We've coupled strongly interacting fermions to light in a high-finesse cavity. There are a few surprises you get when you do that just by observing what you get in transmission spectroscopy. And we are now able to use this to induce new types of order in the cavity, and that is work which is going on at the moment. So with that, thanks for your attention.